Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Early voting starts today in Ohio, so if you're into early voting, you can get started today. Otherwise, if you still have more to learn before you cast your votes, we've invited NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin to tell us what we need to know. We've reached the final stretch. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Let's start with the Ohio gubernatorial race. What do you know about that? It closed up over the last week or so.
Well, says who? I mean, there is a Cincinnati Inquirer poll that had Governor Strickland within 4 points of Kasich, but a new Quinnipiac poll just came out and had John Kasich up by 17 points.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the Democrats will talk to them about the points that show it narrowing, but every other poll shows it pretty much, I don't know if it's spreading, but at least Kasich with a comfortable lead, and that's kind of obviously disheartening for Democrats, especially given the numbers in the Senate race as well.
What should people read into polls? I mean, what do we get out of them? What do average voters get out of them anyways?
Well, we always say it's a snapshot, and who knows if it's accurate or not. And the fact is that in one poll, as you say, one poll has Kasich up by 4, the other one has up by 17.
Mm-hmm.
Something is kind of screwy there. And look, we always go back to, you know, and I always like to talk about this, the New Hampshire primary of 2008, talking about presidential politics, when everybody was convinced that Barack Obama, having won Iowa caucuses 5 days prior, was going to win again, and Hillary Clinton surprised everybody, surprised the polls by winning. And if we didn't know the day of the New Hampshire primary what was going to happen, I mean, we have 5 weeks to go before the election. The problem is, at least the problem for the Democrats is, there doesn't seem to be any turning around in the perception of President Obama, the Democratic Congress, and the direction of the country. And that's what, obviously, with 5 weeks to go, October coming up right around the corner, the Democrats needed some more good news coming out, and so far they haven't heard it.
Yeah, the two issues, the incumbency issue that, you know, they aren't getting the job done. That's come to the fore in the Ohio campaign for governor. And also, you know, what happened on Wall Street's come to the fore. Let's hear a couple ads from both sides. This anti-Strickland one was paid for by the Republican Governors Association.
Said he wouldn't raise taxes. Wouldn't raise taxes. Wouldn't raise taxes.
Strickland?
Who else? That's almost all he said 4 years ago.
But I know how this story ends.
Then Strickland proposed and signed into law a more than $800 million tax increase.
Thought we wouldn't notice. Strickland didn't get the jobs done either.
You know, there's always a risk of incumbency, right, Ken?
Whatever you don't get done. Exactly. I mean, it's one thing, and then that's what the Democrats are wrestling with. Do you try to defend? I mean, it's kind of tough for the Obama administration to say, here's our slogan. I know things suck now, but they really sucked under the Bush administration. I don't think that's a good way for the Democrats to sell their program. But again, that is exactly what Democrats are doing. They say, look, things are not as good as they could be. And obviously, 19 months in the Obama administration, things could be better. But what the steps they did take, the economic stimulus program, the health care overhaul, things like that, that's far and above what the Bush administration had done for 8 years. That's the Democratic argument. But again, if you're just like the Democrats were, just like the Republicans were really disheartened in 2006, 2008, Democrats were on the upswing because of the war, because of the economy, because of the unpopularity of President Bush. Now it's the Democrats whose record is at stake. And, you know, you could blame Bush all you want. You could blame Herbert Hoover all you want. But ultimately, people look at what's going on right now, and they know the Democrats are in charge.
Some folks, supporters of Ted Strickland in Ohio, are confused about a couple things. Why isn't he more forceful? Why doesn't he, for instance, when it comes to the passenger rail issue, come out more strongly for it instead of seeming to apologize by not really saying much of anything? And they're struggling with that. It would bring $400 million to the state of Ohio. Proponents say it would create tens of thousands of new jobs, and yet he backs away from that. What about an issue like that? Why won't Democratic incumbents push for something like that more and wave that flag a little harder?
Well, it's a good question, and the question is whether the way to run for re-election, especially if you're a Democrat in an anti-democratic year, is the way to do it by selling what you've accomplished and what you've done or tried to do in the past 4 years, or do you go after the weaknesses of the opponent? And Kasich certainly has stuff in his record, you know, being employed by Lehman Brothers for all those years, and given the role of Lehman Brothers in the the almost economic collapse of the country, you think that maybe that's the way to go. Look, you know, it's, again, I don't have the greatest record in the world. I didn't do all I hoped to do when I was first elected in 2006. But look at the guy who's going to replace me. He's a guy who, you know, was bought and paid for by Lehman Brothers all these years. And look what Lehman Brothers did to the economy. So I think that's the dilemma the Democrats find themselves in. And I think that's why they're more going on the offense against the Republicans than defending the last 4 years.
Well, let's hear an anti-Kasich ad paid for by the Service Employees International Union.
This is John Kasich.
I didn't run Lehman Brothers. I worked in a two-man office in Columbus.
But this is what Kasich used to say.
I do work on Wall Street. I work on Wall Street. I've said it three times this week. I do work on Wall Street.
The issue is what Kasich did on Wall Street. Kasich pressured Ohio pension officials to invest in Lehman Brothers. Then Lehman Brothers collapsed, and Ohio seniors lost $480 million. So Kasich got rich while Ohio seniors lost their pension money.
Does it still work to bash Wall Street, Ken?
Well, if you have nothing else to say, it does. And I think a lot of Democrats, to their detriment, they have not much else to say in many cases. But I still think Wall Street is an effective bogeyman in this economic climate. And again, if the argument is that what the Obama administration faced coming into office in January 2009 and what they dealt with, what they had to deal with, is far more serious than anybody ever imagined. But again, if I'm struggling to make ends meet, if I've just lost my job or in danger of losing a job, I'm not going to go back to the root causes of things like that. I mean, you know, the history of politics is always blaming the predecessor, but ultimately the voters decide of whether who's at fault. And right now, if I'm suffering and I'm nervous about the future, I look around and I see, well, it's the Democrats who are in power. So they, you know, just like the Republicans paid the price in 2006 and 2008. Perhaps the Democrats paid the price in 2010.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation with Ken Rudin. He's NPR's political editor. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's return to Congress now. Republicans have put forth the Pledge to America.
I keep getting confused
with that other pledge.
Contract
with America, right. This was a more policy-oriented than the contract was. What are the big differences, and how is it resonating with people?
No, and you know, there's a certain mythology about the contract with America. Everybody says, well, you know, it was really the contract with America that got everybody excited in 1994, and that swept Newt Gingrich and the Republicans into control of the House. Thinking back to 1994, I don't really remember people talking about it too much before the election. They certainly talked about it afterwards. But I think what John Boehner and the Republicans did, John Boehner, the House Republican leader and next Speaker of the House if the Republicans take control, what they did with the Pledge to America is to say, look, Democrats keep saying the Republicans are the party of no. They have offered no proposals. They're just standing back and being in the opposition. And I think the Pledge to America is to show that here's what we do stand for. Now, ultimately, it really is a laundry list of stuff we've heard before. No taxes, cut taxes, no government regulation, do what we can to repeal the health care bill. It's not much specifics, but I think it really is to tell some voters out there that we Republicans, when we take power on January 3rd, 2011, we do have a plan, and this is our boilerplate. But ultimately, I don't think people are paying attention to it.
One thing that's not in it, or at least not more than a line or two, is regards the social agenda of the conservative.
And that's interesting. That's a very good point. And it's interesting that when you think of the Tea Party, and you think of the Tea Party, which is the emotional impetus behind the Republican surge this year, the Tea Party people are not talking about gay marriage and abortion and stem cell research and things like that. They really are talking about taxes and a big government, if not a socialist government, according to some, and rolling back tax increases. So they, because the Tea Party does not seem to have any excitement or enthusiasm for these social issues, Republican leaders are standing back as well.
So this Pledge to America is really a pledge to the Tea Party?
What I think it really is, it's a pledge to it's a CYA approach. It's basically what would the Catholic Youth Association. Exactly. It really is, I think, an indication to say that look, here's what we're offering. Yes, we are voting no against the Obama-Pelosi destruction of America, but, and just in case anybody's paying attention, we do favor certain things. We are in favor of some things, and here's our 45-page booklet on it.
Well, let's talk about the issue of gay rights, because and the GOP. There's strong views on that, and of course, former party chairman Ken Mellman just came out and said he's, maybe. Yeah, he came out, period. And the Christian conservatives have warned that the GOP could lose its base if it endorses same-sex marriage or takes on those kind of pro-gay right stands. Where's this going with the GOP now?
Well, that's a good question, too, because when Ken Mellman did announce that he was gay, people weren't jumping off the cliffs. Mm-hmm. They weren't suddenly saying that, this is bad news for the Republican Party. It was almost met by a shrug and a yawn for the most part. But at the same time, you do not see Republican candidates embracing same-sex marriage. A majority of the people, according to most polls, are still opposed to it, but those supporting same-sex unions, civil unions, same-sex marriages is far greater than it was 4 years ago. And, as Karl Rove said, and I think Ohio was one of the examples where they would work on these anti-gay rights, anti-civil unions amendments in referendums in many states to bring out the conservative party faithful. But it seems to be less of an issue this year, and the Republican Party nationally seems to be embracing it less than ever before.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. And Dale, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
More of a comment than a question. I lost my wife in 2006 from breast cancer. I've been unemployed for 19 months. My house is going to be sold at sheriff's auction next month. My employment's going to run out, but I still believe, because I'm not a person that needs instant gratification, but I still believe that the policies that the Obama administration is setting forth are the right ones to turn this huge aircraft carrier. You don't turn it quickly. You don't have instant gratification. It took a while to get here, and it's going to take a while to get back, and that's what the president wrote me in this letter that he sent me when I sent him a letter.
And he wrote you back?
Oh, yeah, he wrote me back.
Ken, what about that instant gratification? Is the American public ever going to be satisfied?
Well, Dale, first of all, I am terribly sorry for your loss, and it's a heartrending story, and I wish you the best. But I agree with you. I mean, on sober second thought, there are a lot of people, Republicans and Democrats alike, who, of course, voted for the bailouts in the end of 2008 and the stimulus package. And the Tea Party folks, go ballistic at something like that, saying this is, what's wrong with the country. But for all we know, we could have been going into an abyss that would have rivaled 1933 or 1929 or whatever, the whole Depression. And so the Obama-Biden argument is that we were in serious, serious big trouble. Everything was failing. The banks, the Wall Street, everything was failing. We had to do what we had to do to make it better. And if this was years in the making, then obviously it was not going to turn around in 19 months. And some people understand that there is, even if there isn't success on the scoreboard so far, it's moving in the right direction. But others say, Dale, other people could say that, I'm losing my job, I'm losing everything, and I'm losing my health insurance, and it's because of Obama. It's because of what these guys have done in the last 19 months. So not everybody has the patience.
Those would be the people who would complain to a fireman that he broke their window out to put out a fire. Why'd you break my window?
Yeah, right. That's a good example.
I didn't run to the Tea Party. I didn't run to extremes. I'm basically a moderate in my thinking, but I still say that we need to wait. 19 months is not enough time.
Okay. Dale, thanks for calling and thanks for listening, and hang in there.
Surely.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to have to take a break. When we return, we will return with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. political editor Ken Rudin will be back with us. If you want to talk to him, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News, and in public radio, listener feedback is very important. We'd like to hear your thoughts on our radio programming, including All Sides with Ann Fisher. NPR is partnering with WOSU, and we're creating an online audience advisory panel, and we want you to be a part of it. Go to WOSU.org/survey, and there you can sign up and send us your thoughts. It's WOSU.org/survey.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts. Breast cancer survivor and author of The Middle Place and Lift, Kelly Corrigan, will share her experiences Thursday, September 30th at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org.
55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:21. Rain showers today, cloudy skies, a high right around 63. A few clouds tonight, a low of 48. Sunshine tomorrow and a high of 72. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Carl,
good morning,
you're on the air. Good morning.
Question for Mr. Rudin. Since he's supposed to be a political analyst, why does he take such a short time span to do his analysis? Specifically, he, like Republicans, are criticizing Governor Strickland for not turning the economy around. This is the economy is the result of a long-term structural deterioration, more than just George Bush. Dates from the time that Bill Clinton brought China into the World Trade Organization and gave it most favored trade status. So it goes back into Clinton. It goes through Bush, Bush's tax cuts, his unfunded wars, and so forth.
Ken,
and
are
suddenly,
you? Yeah.
I want to hear Carl finish.
And the analogy is you buy a used car, and somebody's been driving it on the highway back and forth to work, and it's got minimal wear on it. Someone else has been drag racing, and Strickland's been handed a car that's been drag raced and abused, structural damage, and he's being criticized for not turning around 8 or 10 years of damage in a couple of years. And I'm not hearing from you, Mr. Rudin, the history leading up to this moment. You're analyzing just in the present. Why is that?
Well, it's a fair question, and the way I see it, the way I'm trying to interpret what I see is the way voters are seeing it. And voters are not going back to the birth of Christ to find out what was wrong with things. When you're elected governor in 2006 and you run for re-election in 2010, your argument is not going to be, I had 8 years of Bob Taft and I had 8 years of George Voinovich that really were terrible and I only had 4 years to deal with it. Voters don't have the patience or the wisdom in many cases to look at really the root causes for some of this. And I agree with you.
Go ahead, Ken.
I agree with Carl. Carl's making a very good point. What Obama is facing, what the Democrats are facing, what anybody's is facing now is years in the making. It goes through the 8 years of George W. Bush. It goes through NAFTA and Bill Clinton for 8 years. So, of course, those are important things to determine why we are where we are. But, again, if you're elected governor 4 years ago and to come back 4 years later and say, look, I'm blaming everything on the last 8 years of Bob Taft, I don't think voters – that may be understandable and it may be realistic, because how do you turn around something that's been in the making for so long? But voters don't want to hear that. I wasn't defending that, and I wasn't making the argument that it is Strickland's fault and it is Obama's fault. I'm just making the case that voters, when they have to review a governor's term, be it 4 years or 8 years, they decide whether they are better off than they were 4 years ago, and many people saying the answer is no.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Carl, thanks for your call. 614-292-8513. And Scott, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ken Rudin. Hi, Ann Trister. I love your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Earlier, you spoke about the Karl Rove gay rights referenda across all the states as a national strategy. Is either party doing that this year? And, you know, with respect to getting different referenda in different states on the ballot in order to bring out the base of voters. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, marijuana laws in California.
Well, marijuana laws are, I think, are different. I don't know what vote that brings out, because there are two sides to this story. But I think because the economy is so bad and recognized as so bad, forget about whose fault it is, although maybe we shouldn't forget about whose fault it is. But the point is, the economy is bad. I think when the economy is all center stage, other social issues, other, you know, I always think, go back to 1988 when the first Bush and the first Dukakis were running for president, and they talked about the Pledge of Allegiance and the ACLU. And obviously, if the economy were really, really bad in 1988, they wouldn't have wasted so much time with such nonsense issues. So I kind of think, I'm not saying that gay rights and social issues like that on the ballot are a waste of time, but I think a sign that the economy was much better in 2000 and 2004, but certainly in 2000, because you had time to work yourselves up about these distractions like gay rights and things like that. But right now, with the economy holding center stage, I think Republicans feel that it would be kind of silly to waste time with peripheral issues like that.
That's a great answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
614-292-8513. And we'll talk about the Tea Party now. Carol, welcome to the show. You're on the air with Ken Rudin.
Hi. You know, I've been a Democrat all my life and all this, but I really, really believe from the bottom of my soul that the reason this Tea Party started and it formed is because we elected a black president. I believe with deep in my soul that they will deny it and deny it and deny it, and they probably don't even accept it to themselves, that many people are not ready to accept a black president, and they are more willing to find mistakes in everything he does. And it just seems to me to be too coincidental that 4 or 5 months after he takes the oath of office, this, you know, and, you know, it's something this country can't talk about still. They can't. I mean, and they know better to come out and say, well, we just don't want this black man. You know, and I think they're angry. And I don't, nothing you say will ever convince me against it. I am married to a foreigner of Muslim extraction. And for the first time since the first Gulf War, I'm afraid again, because we have had the phone calls. We have had, you know, the nasty things said to us. There's an underlying bigotry. You see how quickly Muslims have become the bad guy in this country. So there's always somebody who's a scapegoat, but I'm convinced it's because Obama's black. Absolutely convinced.
Ken?
Well, Carol makes very, very important points. And one thing I want to address is that it's not that we don't talk about it, because I think race is certainly under-discussed, but it's something that we've got to talk about. And yet, I don't think we accomplish anything. In other words, in all the talking we've done, I think we just talk at each other. And for all the emotional speech that Obama made as a candidate in Philadelphia regarding Reverend Wright, the questions about race, that silly beer summit they had between in Cambridge, Massachusetts, between the white officer and the black professor. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, nothing gets accomplished. Do I think race plays a big role? I do. Do I think it is the only role? I don't. I think a lot of the hate I heard a lot of hate directed at Bill Clinton during his 8 years. I heard a lot of hate directed at George W. Bush. I saw a lot of signs with Bush, with the Hitler mustache, that Bush is a fascist, Bush is a Nazi. I've seen a lot of that. And I'm not saying that just because we saw it with Clinton and Bush means it's just politics as usual to see it with Obama. I do think race is a part of it. And it's a regretful part of it. But I think there's just an uncertainty when jobs are disappearing left and right, when the economy was almost, you know, completely gone with the banks and the auto companies and all that stuff in 2008, 2009, there's a fear out there. And when a fear takes hold, it becomes either ethnic-based, as we've seen against Muslims, especially since 9/11, or black-based, since we've seen against Obama since January of 2009. So it's ugly, and I think that's what fear is all about. It's irrational, and it's irrational.
Well, you know, you can't blame the Democrats for the last 8 years. I'm sorry. You know, the night George Bush was elected, I stood outside. It was a warm November night, and I thought, we're going to get what we deserve. And now they're going to turn the clock back around to, I'm just horrified. I think there's a lack of education in this country. There's a lack of smarts. And I think, in some respect, the media blows this action. I mean, these rallies and stuff, they put it in the paper. So everybody starts to think, well, everybody feels this way. And a lot of us don't. And I'm just horrified. And, you know, I give up. I'm about ready to move somewhere. But, you know, I truly believe in the core of this country, you know. But everybody's, I don't know. It's a long story. But thanks for your discussing it with me. Bye.
Thanks, Carol. Thanks for your call.
Carol, I understand exactly what Carol's saying, but another problem is, and maybe I don't know if this is media driven or poll driven, mm-hmm. and there was an early question about the effects of polls, but if I'm a Democrat and I'm looking into these polls that we're going to get clobbered in the House, mm-hmm. we're going to get clobbered in the Senate, we're going to lose all these governorships, I may just stay home. And I think just like many Republicans stayed home in 1974 during Watergate, mm-hmm. they stayed home in 2006 and 2008. Now Democrats are saying, you know, Obama is not the perfect guy. We're still in Afghanistan. We still have Guantanamo. We're still in Iraq. It's not everything is not accomplished the way I wanted it. I may just stay home. And again, that's what Obama and Biden and the Democrats say you cannot do. You've got to, even though we're not perfect, think of the alternative. And that's basically what what November 2nd is going to be all about.
You know, the Tea Party emerged as sort of an outsider party, but if the recent primaries are any example, they're as in-party as you can get. They're just bumping the old-timers out of the Republican Party.
It's clear that the Tea Party sees Barack Obama as a socialist, and they think he's not a citizen, and he's un-American, and they want to stop his agenda. But at the same time, they despise the Republican establishment. They hate the Lisa Murkowskis and the Mike Castles in Delaware. They think they're just, you know, part of the establishment, part of the problem. There's no difference between the Democrats and Republicans. And so they will oust, you know, even like Robert Bennett, who's a conservative Republican in Utah, mm-hmm. but he voted for a bailout. So obviously he's a sellout. Get rid of him. Mike Castle, if you're a Republican and you want control of the Senate, nobody was going to win that seat in Delaware but Mike Castle, who's been in office, I think, since 1066. I mean, he's been around forever.
100 years,
yet,
I think.
Yeah, that's a long time. And yet Christine O'Donnell, who, look, you know, you talk about whether Barack Obama was born in this country. I mean, I'm not convinced Christine O'Donnell was born on this planet. I mean, some of the things she says is just outlandish, and yet she defeated somebody like Mike Castle, which just shows not only the anger, but the irrationality that's out there.
And it wasn't stunning. Just where there's a high population. I mean, she did it almost across the board in that state.
Exactly right. Right. And, you know, and everything about her, when she graduated, her issues, her views about social issues and marriage and things like that. I mean, the Wilmington News Journal said yesterday they're kooky, but obviously it's a majority of the Republican Party in Delaware.
You know, getting back to the president, too, he's been out and about now. He's getting out trying to get out the vote, but there's been criticism, and I think Bill Clinton was one of his critics, is not being forceful enough. You're not being angry enough.
You know what's funny about this? One quick thing about Bill Clinton. When he campaigned in South Carolina in 2008 for Hillary Clinton against Barack Obama, when Obama won South Carolina big, Bill Clinton, I thought, was almost a despicable response, saying that, well, of course Obama won. After all, Jesse Jackson won South Carolina twice and no big deal. And I kept thinking, Bill Clinton has come and gone. It's time for him to leave the scene. And yet, looking at 2010, there is no better campaigner, in my mind, or at least on the Democratic side, than Bill Clinton. He is excited. He is angry. He is forceful. And the problem about Barack Obama from the beginning, he was always professorial. He was always, you know, a thinking man's candidate. But right now, with the Democrats on the ropes, you need somebody who's a fighter. And Clinton, I thought, you know, I've criticized Clinton in the past for tactics I thought were just above and beyond, but I've changed my mind about him this year. I think he's a very effective fighter for the Democratic Party, and I understand what he's saying about Barack Obama, that he should be the same way, but that's not Obama's nature. He's never been that kind of guy, especially for most of the 19 months. He's been leaning over backwards, trying to make accommodations with the Republicans, while the left, you know, the progressive base saying, stop it, fight, you know, be a fighter, make it us against them, don't be so accommodating. So the left, the left progressive wing of the Democratic Party is pretty disillusioned with 5 weeks to go. But one more thing about this, and I know I can't stop talking.
That's what we have you on for.
But what happens in 2010 has nothing to do with 2012, and we Democrats and Republicans have to realize that. We, you know, in 1982, the Republicans and Ronald Reagan lost 26 House seats. They were on the ropes. And 2 years later, Reagan won 49 states. Bill Clinton and the Democrats took a huge beating in 1994 with Gingrich and company winning the House and the Senate. And 2 years later, Clinton easily beat Bob Dole. So whatever, as bad as it looks for the Democrats, as good as it looks for the Republicans on November 2nd, that has nothing to do with what's going to happen in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton, I mean, he's a great example of someone who has nine lives. You know, 2 years ago, no one wanted to be near him.
Including Hillary.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Now everybody wants him and no one wants the president around.
Well, you know something, he could say things that, I mean, look, Carol made a very good point about race, and we saw this John Murtha district, this special election in Pennsylvania a few months ago where the Democrats held onto the seat. They didn't want Obama in there. They just, you know, Obama is still this black guy from Chicago or Washington. They don't want in this rural Pennsylvania district, but Bill Clinton was there, and Bill Clinton was, you know, with a clenched fist and the tough words for the Republicans, and the Democrats held that seat.
Okay. Let's see, 614-292-8513. And, Doug, you're on the air. You say the Tea Party's a rebranding.
That's right. Well, yeah, because, you know, George Bush drove the country in the ditch. But going back to about when President Obama starts to fight or gets a little angry, you know, Matt Drudge plays the race card and says Obama goes street. So he's kind of boxed in on that. And, you know, every time that there's a Democratic president, these billionaires fund these opposition groups. They did it to JFK with the John Birch Society and President Clinton with the Arkansas Project. And my other point is that, you know, we need a so-called Tea Party in the Democratic Party and to get rid of the Blue Dog Democrats who, you know, side with the Republicans often, want the tax cuts for the rich, and they're obstructing a lot of the Obama agenda.
Any chance of that, Ken?
Well, Doug makes a very good point. However, the Democrats control the House, or at least they have a majority of the House, because of these Blue Dog Democrats who were elected in these Republican districts in 2006 and 2008. A lot of them are pro-life. A lot of them are anti-tax. A lot of them are very conservative on social issues. And the Democrats, like Rahm Emanuel, said, look, I don't care what their ideology is. If they can win, we want them. And so Democrats, you know, the moderate to liberal wing of the Democratic Party basically are responsible for these Blue Dogs who came in 2006 and 2008 because Nancy Pelosi would not be Speaker without them. But I agree. I mean, think of all the times, the months that the Democrats had 60 seats, which is remarkable, 60 seats in the Senate in 2009, and it took them months and months before they could accomplish anything, before health care. And a lot of the Democrats had their own petty personal privileges they wanted. Joe Lieberman wanted this, and Ben Nelson of Nebraska wanted this, and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana wanted that, and Blanche Lincoln wanted that. And so instead of coming together and trying to give Obama victories, they all had their little agenda, their own separate agendas, and by the time they turned around, Scott Brown and the Tea Party won in Massachusetts, and there went their 60 votes.
Doug, thanks for your call.
All right, thank you.
We're going to have to take another break. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, political editor. If you want to talk with Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations that you won't hear anywhere else.
Do you understand love?
Well, I understand caring. See, most of my relationships are more intellect, and to me, love is caring.
posing questions to fascinating people like Temple Grandin and giving them the time to answer on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on today's edition of the show. Terrence Winter is the Emmy Award-winning writer for The Sopranos, and he will discuss his enduring fascination with New Jersey gangsters and talk about his new HBO series, Boardwalk Empire. That discussion at noon on WOSU 820 NPR News. And beginning tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV, director Ken Burns returns to his exploration of America's national pastime that he began with his landmark 1994 series, Baseball. Now Burns updated the series with the 10th inning. This new two-part, four-hour film tells the tumultuous story of our national pastime. It celebrates baseball's new golden age and sheds light on one of the game's darkest chapters, the steroids era. The series begins tonight at 8. On WOSU-TV. 55 degrees at 11:41. Rain showers today. Cloudy skies, a high of 63. Clouds tonight, a low of 48. Sunshine tomorrow and a high of 72. All Sides continues on WOSU-820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks again for being with us.
Ann, it's a lot of fun. My pleasure.
614-292-8513. And Chris, you're on the air. You want to talk about redistricting. I know Ohio's set to lose two congressional seats in the U.S. House in 2012. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, thanks very much. Yes, my comment is basically that this is the year that I think that all voters need to not forget about and be complacent about, because it's a census year, and parties who are in power will be using their power to draw up new lines for districts. And that's my comment.
And in Ohio, that's the governor, the state auditor, Secretary of State, and
legislature, right?
Yeah, the legislature, right.
And the legislature, mm-hmm. Right.
Well, that's critical. I mean, a lot of people focus on the control of the Senate and how many, you know, is Christine O'Donnell going to win in Delaware? But for the most part, and Chris is exactly right, it's the gubernatorial elections, the 37 races for governor this year, especially in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York, which will lose congressional districts, and states like Florida, Texas, and perhaps Arizona that will gain. And the way you win, you gain or lose congressional districts is that whoever controls the political apparatus, the governor and the state legislature. So if, for example, if John Kasich is elected governor in Ohio, and Ohio is going to lose two congressional districts, and they control the state legislature as well, well, you know that in addition to the three freshman members of the House, Mary Jo Kilroy, Driehaus, and Boccheri, who could very well lose, that there are also other Democrats like Zach Space, like Betty Sutton. They may redraw the districts in such a way that they either throw Democrats together or they eliminate them completely. So, you know, we talk about the Senate and the House all we want, but gubernatorial races, especially in states like Ohio, are critical in 2010.
Chris, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have an email now from Aaron. If you'd like to email us, the address is allsides@wosu.org. And Aaron writes, perhaps we should resurrect the Bull Moose Party. We need a forceful, progressive presence, liberal but not touchy-feely or wimpy. Ken?
I think the words I'm thinking of are lots of luck. I think the only time you'll get a third party to be effective at all is either a Ross Perot type who had $100 gazillion at his disposal, which is not the case for many third party candidates. Think of Ralph Nader, for example, or George Wallace when you had race as an issue in 1968 and he won like a half a dozen seats states in the South. But for the most part, we seem to be just, you know, nurtured and on the Democrats and Republicans, and third parties just don't have a say. Part of it is our fault because, for example, I mean, I know there are Libertarian candidates and there are Green Party candidates in key races for the Senate and House and governor, but either we run out of time or the candidates themselves don't have money, and so we ignore them. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You think that, well, maybe if we talked about these candidates, they might have something to say, and they might show and prove it to be a significant alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. But, you know, it's our fault, too, because we don't talk about that much. We're at this point, with 5 weeks to go, we are very horse race conscious, and this third party, these other candidates, are not part of the consciousness.
Right now, it's really all about money and what you can spend. And, Roger, you're on the air. You want to talk about the impact of outside funding.
Yes. Incidentally, I agree with a lot of what's been said today, you know, people calling in, you know, about the Democrats and the Republican record and so forth. Also, the redistricting, if anybody's ever seen maps of the districts, you know, they're anything but compact. My question is that how much, you know, especially in the case of Kasich and Ron Portman, I wonder how much outside money is coming in to elect these people, especially from, you know, Tea Party billionaires and conservative causes and so forth.
Well, we've learned there was a very good article in The New Yorker several weeks ago by Jane Mayer, basically about the Koch brothers, who are, you know, we talk about the Tea Party being this grassroots kind of organization, but there are millionaires, billionaires, conservative millionaires and billionaires like the Koch brothers, who are funding many of these conservative groups, the Dick Armey groups, the Tea Party groups. And so it's one thing for this to be a spontaneous rally of Tea Party activists who are just, you know, mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. But at the same time, the money that's behind it is very insidious, and a lot of people just don't know where it's coming from. And of course, as we've said over and over again, the Supreme Court decision, the Citizens United decision of several months ago that basically said that corporations could spend whatever they want, has really shown to be very effective, especially in the last couple of weeks and the last month alone. Outside groups supporting Republican candidates or nominally supporting Republican candidates have outspent their Democratic-leaning rivals 6-1. And, you know, a lot of people thought, well, maybe we're not going to see much of that money in 2010. It'll be probably coming out in 2012. But it's just unbelievable how much of the airwaves have been blanketed by these shadowy groups that nobody's ever heard of in the last couple of weeks.
That's one thing I'm in agreement with. You know, one thing I would like to see is more transparency. You know, whenever these groups come up, you know, and you get you know, names like Americans for Democracy and so forth. You know, and nothing is really shown, you know, so far as who's contributing to these groups and so forth. You know, you mentioned the Koch brothers, you know, Koch Industries and so forth. As being one, you know, and I suggest people, you know, read up on the Koch brothers. I think they might find it interesting, you know, their history. So, at any rate, I do want to thank you for your time and have a good day and good luck to, you know, you and the other pundits in this campaign or whatever.
Thanks, Rod.
Whatever we call that. No, thanks, Aaron. But he was absolutely right. I mean, it's just, you know, and recently in the last couple of weeks, the Democrats tried to bring up in the Senate, said, look, okay, we understand the Supreme Court decision. You can spend whatever you want, but at least let us know where the money has come from. And the Republicans blocked the vote.
614-292-8513. And Fred, you're on the air. You want to know why can't the Democrats figure out what they're doing wrong?
Right. You know,
like what?
You know, well, first of all, the people that put the Republicans in and that put our country under are basically in the financial industry. And when it comes to money, the CEOs and the CFOs and the way the insurance companies and mortgage companies conduct themselves is like a person who's money is like alcohol to them. So the question would be, you know, if you had people who wrecked the car because they kept drinking, would you give them a new car and 3 months of bourbon to do with what they want? Essentially, that's what the TARP did. There seems to be a total lack of understanding of human nature and of where the power of the Democratic Party really comes from. We have a corporate party. It's called the Republican Party. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. And then we have another party called the Democratic Party. Well, what Obama did, my question is why he can't figure it out, is he had a supply-side Reaganomics run his recovery program. And we're losing our businesses. The Democrats are mostly small businessmen, independents, traditional religionists, and we're just totally ignored. So we're losing our businesses. You try to get a loan to do a few houses or to do something in the city, and only the big projects are getting the money. And so what people are seeing is that the Democratic Party, the hierarchy, has just forgotten who they are. The second point is why they don't understand. Why doesn't President Obama understand that he doesn't understand the power of the presidency? First 6 months, he could have had the toadstool become the national flower. People have done anything for him. So what does he do? He does a kumbaya, then he gives all of the power back to the people that are going to defeat the Democrats because he gave all the money unrestrained to the people that's going to undo everything the Democratic Party responds to. Unless you're a UAW worker or because of ethnic reasons you feel so tied to this man, I personally and the people I talk to who I talked into voting for Obama just throw up our hands. We just can't understand. What are you doing? Why can't you see what you're doing? That's my question.
Okay. Thanks, Fred.
Well, there are some people who will argue that the Democratic Party is as much of a corporate party as the Republican Party. They do rely a lot on corporate funds and union funds and everything. But when you think of the Rahm Emanuels of the world, I mean, Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff, who made millions of dollars as a corporatist. You think of some of the people that President Obama brought in to run the economy, the people like the Larry Summers and the Geithners and those people who either have Wall Street backgrounds or close to Robert Rubin, who were responsible for the mess to begin with. So some people say that there is not much difference between the two parties, between the Democrats and the Republicans. But, you know, it's just remarkable. And that's part of the frustrations that so many Democrats have, that they do feel that they were given a choice in 2008 between the status quo that was not working and a new hope of Obama, and they went with the latter. And yet, as you say, Fred, a lot of people are throwing up their hands because the change that they were promised and the change that they expected just never came to pass.
Right. Is there any way of enlightening these people that they're going to be out of power, that it's not going to work?
Not in 5 weeks, I don't think so, but there is in 2012 to start all over again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. 614-292-8513. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. If you have a question or comment, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And let's see.
And before you go on, yeah. Do you know, by the way, Ann, that on October 13th, myself and the Talk of the Nation crew will be in Columbus, Ohio?
Nobody told me.
Nobody,
no,
that's not true.
No, I never know anything. No,
well,
no
October,
one.
On Wednesday the 13th, we're doing the show from Columbus, Ohio. That is, I think, like one of the main cities in Ohio, isn't it?
I guess we'll actually get to meet
like
each other in person, won't we?
That's right. That's right. That's by the way, you'll be very disappointed.
Well, so will you. We're equal. But
thank God for Facebook.
You know, our show is now being broadcast on Ohio Government Television, so I'm on TV.
Wow.
You're not right now. Well, you're still over a phone line, but I'm on television. You have a new website.
We do. My political junkie column, blog, whatever we want to call it, mm-hmm. has been incorporated into a larger thing called It's All Politics. In addition to all the nonsense that I write about and all the other breaking political news of the day, of the week, of the hour, mm-hmm. I also do an analysis of every Senate, gubernatorial and major House race in the country and where it's leaning and what's at stake and biographies of the candidates, things like that. And you can be found at npr.org/ I don't know what. But if you go to slash junkie, you'll find it there.
Right. I mean, it's just easy to just say Ken Rudin junkie.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And
the guy who, unlike Ann, is not on TV.
Someday your ship will come in. 614-29... Where am I? 292-8513. And my associate producer, Amy Jurevich, said she knew you were going to be in town. So, you know what, Ken? They probably told me, and
I don't think they waste time with TV stars. I think they just.
That's it. I really, I'm getting nosebleeds now. Okay, Roger, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You want to talk about filibustering?
Yeah. I wondered if he could comment on the Democrats' strategy of not actually calling the Republicans on their threat to a filibuster.
I love that question because I think the same thing all the time. If I mean, never in my life have I ever seen a Senate where you had to have 60 votes just to go to the bathroom. I mean, you just, you know, you need 60 votes for everything. It's no longer majority rule. You have to have 60 votes. You have to stop the filibuster by getting 60 votes. So why don't, correct English, why don't the Democrats make the Republicans stand up there for 17 hours, like with Jimmy Stewart and Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington, make them filibuster in person instead of just threaten a filibuster and therefore everybody runs away and they're scared? I think the reason the Democrats don't do it is because one of these days they're going to be in the minority, perhaps sooner than they expect, and then the Republicans will run things and they'll want to filibuster things too. But it's really, you know, people in the country say, what kind of a filibuster is this? Just because somebody arches an eyebrow and threatens to filibuster, therefore, if you don't have 60 votes, everything gets taken down, nominations go away. It's just lunacy. And I've never, ever, and I've been covering politics a long time, I've never seen a Senate that depends entirely now on 60 votes and not a majority rule of 50 plus one.
Roger.
Roger's right. I mean, it's just, you know, it's out of control.
I mean, I can't believe that the Republicans could benefit by standing up there and stopping some of these bills that the Democrats are trying to get passed.
They haven't paid for it yet. I mean, we'll see on November 2nd, but right now a lot of Democrats like to say they're the party of no, but right now in many of these key races around the country, House and Senate, Republicans are not paying the price.
Okay, Roger.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 614-292-8513. We have a couple minutes left. And, Paul, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann, Ken. I know our time is short. I would like to agree with a previous caller that I think racism is an underlying factor from day one. Okay, that said, I think that part of our problem is structural in terms of the haves versus the have-nots. And we have allowed corporations and individuals to hold, sway. And granted, you know, yeah, maybe your mutual fund owns half of the people who are doing you in. But the fact is, you know, what else are you going to do? When somebody makes, 800 times as a CEO what the factory worker makes, there's bound to be serious imbalance. And that person and others like him or her have the funds to skew via media the perception of the very factory worker who is now voting against his or her own best interests. I'll take comments off the air. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, we saw in 2006 and 2008, if you make the case that during the Bush administration it was the energy industry and the drug lobby and although the pharmaceutical industry that really ran the government, you had 2006 and 2008 elections where it said, enough of this, get rid of them, this is what's destroying the country. And yet, in the eyes of many Democrats, this is exactly what we're leaning towards again on November 2nd, the fact that the people who have been discredited in the past are suddenly becoming the hope of the future. And that's why, this goes back to a lot of early calls in this program where, I mean, this is 19 months we're talking about. You know, the administration is trying to turn things around after 19 months, and people are suddenly, have this nostalgia for the Bush years. And I'm not, being critical of it, but I just know that when Bush left office, his numbers were in the low 20s, and people were not sorry to see him go. And now there's a nostalgia for him, which is just pretty remarkable.
That's all the time we have with Ken Rudin. Ken, I'll see you on October 13th.
Well, I'm going to see Amy. I'm not going to see you.
Amy, that's right.
You don't know about it.
Ken Rudin, thank you very much for being with us today. That's Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, political editor. That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU, and this is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.